All right, we are back on another edition of the Unload Podcast. Subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. If there was ever an episode that was going to get me canceled, this is going to be the one. I am here with one of my best friends in the whole world. We've been friends since you were in seventh grade, I think, when we met. Or were you in sixth?
I think I was in sixth. I think you and Chris had already gone off to Barrett Middle School. And I was stuck behind at good old Dewey Elementary.
Yeah, that was so it's been, oh man, so that would have been, that's been like 30 years, man.
Yeah, like 30 years at this point.
Jeez. Well, the good news is that you, Chris, and I have mutually assured destruction. You know, it's like one of those things where it's like, we know that if any of us ever ran for office, we could for sure tank the campaign. We just don't.
Oh, you know? You're definitely on the short list of people I'd have killed before I announced my candidacy.
Oh, man. You know, it was interesting. You know, for those of you who don't know Brian and Chris Johnson and I, for those of you who are back in the, you know, the people who actually know me personally have known me for a long time. We were just like the three amigos. Like you were friends with Chris, I think, first, because I moved in around that time. And then I kind of became friends with Chris. We had done fast offerings together at church. And then we just naturally, because you were his friend and I was his friend, we kind of ended all hanging out together. And then we basically just became like the three amigos of that ward, you know?
We did so much stupid stuff together. Chris is so quiet. In retrospect, you go, oh, he was more introverted. And so it was like you and I just taking shots at him nonstop. If you begin to laugh.
Well, that was what I was going to tell you, because one of the things I want to interview you on is you left, I think, was it your freshman year when you moved from California to Indy?
It was just before sophomore year.
Yeah, because it was in the summer, right?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah. So the dynamic changed dramatically when you left. I don't think we ever talked about it, because you're right. Like, it was actually really interesting, because you and I were very kind of renegade friend, you know, for different reasons that we don't need to talk about, but we were definitely both a little out there and a little more adventurous and got in a lot of trouble. And Chris was really the one who kind of like, I should have talked to him about coming on here, but it wouldn't have been the same podcast. We'll have to do that later. But like you know, he was the one who was always kind of keeping us in check.
Sure. For sure.
He was the Jiminy Cricket of our group. You know what I mean? Well, not just because of that, but also because the thing that was fun though is with you and me together, we could convince him to do
things.
Yeah, we got him into it.
You mean like when the three of us were like, I don't know, let's see if we can write letters to a poor girl who just got kidnapped?
Oh no, we don't need to talk. I'm gonna have to, this will be the one episode that I edit. That's a story I don't need to share. That was the dumbest thing ever. That is what happens when you have a pack of 500 sour gummy worms from Costco and a 2-liter bottle of Squirt and three guys who are middle school. Man, what a,
you know, here's the way I say this to this day about myself. And I think that it held true for all three of us. Our sense of humor and our sense of morals did not always line up. Like, we would always do the right thing, but we always found humor in the craziest stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I always operated, and I still kind of do, on the assumption of like, yeah, this is on the line, but if this works out, what a great story. You know what I mean?
And no risk, no reward, man.
Yeah, and like, we have a ton of great stories, you know, from that stuff. So, but yeah, so tell me, I mean, first of all, for those of you who know Brian, he's got, I feel like you have just completely two separate lives, because you have the California Brian that we knew, yeah, and then you became the Indiana Brian that you now are. So yeah, let's start from the beginning. Tell us about where you land in the birth order and where you grew up and yeah, how you know, all those things.
So I'm number 4 out of 6 kids, 3 boys, 3 girls. Came from a pretty tight knit family. You know, we grew up in Sacramento, and my dad was on the road probably 45 to 48 weeks out of the year. And his 2 oldest had already graduated and the rest of us were still at home. And he kind of got to a point where he said, if I don't change jobs, if I don't get off the road, I'm never going to actually have been around any of my kids. And so he, my freshman year, he kind of said, hey, we're thinking about moving to Indiana. And, you know, at the time you think, oh, this is this cool, exciting adventure. And then you see the cornfields of Indiana, and you realize, you know, it's not.
yeah.
You know, we ended up moving just before the start of sophomore year. And when we did that, like I said, like, I was kind of like, hey, this would be a fresh start. It'd be kind of cool. And then, you know, even driving across the country, you're just excited for what the unknown, right? Like the next chapter of life. But then I got to Indiana, and about 2 or 3 weeks later, it kind of wore off. The charm wore off, not because the people were bad, but because Chris and Josh aren't here. And, you know, I can't say, hey, come over, we're playing video games, or hey, we're doing a sleepover at Josh's house. Cause I mean, we slept at your house nonstop.
Yeah. I mean, every summer you guys practically lived at my house, you know?
I mean, it was crazy. And the funny thing was, it was like, there was 2 albums that kind of were the, like, we would literally sit there and play video games and listen to Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pill.
I love that woman. I love that woman so much.
And then when we weren't listening to that, we listened to the No Doubt album, right?
Yeah, I love that woman so much too. Oh, for different reasons.
Yeah, no doubt, right? God, but then we'd play video games till like 11 o'clock. We'd put on something like Demolition Man in your room, and you know, we would just stay up sane and doing the dumbest things, including figuring out who could sneak out of the house, streak up and down the block while banging pants, and then sneak back into the house while still naked and get up the stairs past your parents' bedroom.
This is the part where editing comes in. Man, we had a lot of good times. We did a lot of weird things, but we had some fun. You know, I just remember even walking up to the Quick Stop.
Oh yeah.
And just, you know, we would just go up there and we would get slushies and shock tarts. Were you there when I busted all my taste buds on shock tarts?
I think I was, but I was also there when we all decided it was a good idea to like hammer 4 Jolt Colas.
Yeah, so that's the thing, man. The shock tarts thing. I tell my kids this all the time, because ever since then, I could eat anything that's spicy, you know, and it doesn't bother me at all. And so, yeah, I remember we had, you know, shock tarts. I don't think they sell them. I haven't seen them in years, but yeah, I remember you guys dared me to put a whole pack in my mouth at once, and then my tongue bled, and then ever since then, I can eat anything as spicy as you want, and it doesn't bother me.
No. So,
no, I can still taste sweet and sour and all that, but for some reason, spice doesn't bother me. Yeah.
Have you tried the one chip challenge then?
Yeah, I did, and it didn't do a thing.
Nothing.
Well, what happened was, so my son bought it for me, and so I ate it, but then I inhaled some of the powder, so down in my throat I could feel it, and I was coughing a bit, but as far as like my mouth on fire, No, I don't even think I might. I don't even think I teared up.
Yeah. So you're dead inside.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it'll get me the next day, if you know what I mean, you know, but as far as the mouth, like there's no problems. Yeah. I was wanting to sit in a bathtub full of ice cubes the next day. You know what I mean? But, but right there. Yeah, no, it was. Yeah,
that's honey, do we have any more of that Desitin baby powder?
Yeah, right. So, Yeah, man. So it's but you know, yeah. So moving to Indiana, though, I got to imagine, because I've been to both. I served a mission in Indiana, right?
There you
go. And in fact, your singles ward was my first area. You know, so we got to hang out while I was a missionary. Spend Christmas at your house, and
that's right.
And like, it is such a culture shock. It's just a different world out there.
Indiana is really different. So. I always say, like, there's destination cities around the country, like New York, LA, Miami, Dallas, Seattle, like Chicago. These are big cities that draw people from all kinds of cultural backgrounds, all kinds of races and ethnicities and experiences. Indiana just isn't a destination location unless you're a major race fan for the 500, right? And so for the most part, people that are from Indiana stay in Indiana. And then nobody's really coming unless it's through job transfer. So it's just, it's really kind of just kind of singular. And it's like, this is who we are, you know, and mm-hmm. to its credit, you know, you get a lot of like storied traditions within Indiana because of the consistency of like my father, my grandfather, my great grandfather was here, but our restaurants have suffered dramatically because of that.
Hmm.
You know, we don't have the ethnic foods. We don't have all the things that, like, when Sacramento, like, you look around Sacramento, I mean, it's the United Nations as a city, right? Like, there's people from everywhere doing everything. It's just, you don't have that in Indiana, not by comparison.
No. Although, so it was actually funny. I'll tell you this story. I thought this was really funny. When I was on my mission, I used to love to go to Don Pablo's. You know this. And, sure. But I like going there because you could get prayer fried bean dip for $5 and some tortillas, and that was it. Like, and when you're a missionary and you're trying to eat cheap, that's a great meal, right? And so I remember coming out and visiting you, and we took that infamous trip to Chicago at South Bend, and you had me stop at some Don Pablo's with you, and you were like, not the same, right? And I was like, yeah, not the same.
Yo, R.I.P. Don Pablo's, it's gone now.
Is it really? It's gone?
Gone. It's all gone.
Oh, that's such a bummer. That's such a bummer. Yeah, man. So when you got there, you mentioned, you know, Indy being kind of like, you know, everybody who's there stays. Did you feel, were you kind of couched as like an outsider, like people didn't want to hang out with you, or were you kind of like the cool kid because you're from California?
You know, I always tell people, like, you know, growing up, I had ADHD pretty good, right? And
couldn't imagine.
Know, no, couldn't tell. Can't see the line, can you? but this is back in the day before it was a household term, right? And so, you know, I'm learning how to deal with it, and my parents are still trying to figure out how to deal with it. And people that knew me since I was a kid kind of always said, yeah, he's a little wild, but he's got a good heart. Well, when people don't know you since you're a kid, you know, you lose all of that. And so in the beginning, it was kind of like, hey, I was the new kid from California. And after a while, it was like, all right, you know, this guy's got a lot of energy. And
that's part of your charm, dude. Like, I got to tell you, like, the thing that was so funny about you, and Chris and I always joked about this, was that first of all, like, I will admit this now, but like you were a good looking kid. Like, you know what I mean? The girls dug you, you know, you were athletic and you were fun, and that high energy for like 10 minutes was like a real charm, you know?
Right. Yeah. Hey, hell of a first impression.
Yeah, so your first impression was great, and so you would draw in the girls, you would draw them in, and then you'd get it to be a little too much for them, and then that's when we would take over, you know?
Yeah, that's like, when you pulled out your old tie with the, hey, I got poo on my tie. This guy, well, in case you didn't grow up anywhere around the San Juan building between 1996 and 2000, Josh Edlow would pick up on women by wearing a Winnie the Pooh tie and say, would you believe it? I got poo on my tie. And it works way too well. It, like, to this day, it unnerves me, the fact that, like, people be like, oh, you do? What's your name?
It shocked me that that worked so well. I was like, it was such an easy icebreaker, and it was the dumbest thing, and it worked. That was almost as dumb as my cuddle cards, which also worked.
Oh my!
To a cuddle. That was I don't think you were around for that. Yeah. So when I got back from my mission,
I remember the cuddle cards.
Yeah, good for one free cuddle, and I'll tell you what, they worked.
They got redeemed.
Yeah, there were a few redemptions. Yeah. I always told them when I handed it to them, I was like,
well, weren't you?
That's what I would hand it to them, and I would say, you play your cards right, you'll get a power snuggle. And
can you help your audience identify, or what's the difference between a power snuggle and just a regular cuddle, Josh?
Here's the secret. There, I have no idea. I would just say it. Yeah. Yeah, that was a good one too. Oh man. Yeah, so you get to Indiana, I mean, cuz I came out and visited you even before my mission. I came out and visited you one summer.
Yeah.
And like you generally you had a big group of friends.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so this holds true to this day. You know, I'm very fortunate to have a wife who knew who I was from the beginning and said, look, you just got in. Once you get past it, he's fine. But part of my strategy for having ADHD and having so much energy was, you know, I can burn the candle at both ends. And so if you're going to do that, you got to have a pretty deep bench of people that you run through with, right?
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. We were carved from the same cloth in that, like I was, you and I, you know, some of the guys we ran with, like, you know, we always talk about Chris. I'm sure he'll listen to this at some point. Chris was very selective on who he hung out with.
Extremely.
We were lucky to be like the inner circle in my mind with him, because he was pretty closed off. Like he just had his group and he would be with those people. But he wasn't particularly social, you know?
No, he wasn't. But, you know, the thing about Chris was he was a high quality character. He just wasn't willing to spread himself thin.
But that was the thing, is he also didn't have the energy that we had. Like you and I could run, we could be out till 3-4 in the morning and we had no problem. You know, He, there'd be nights that he wouldn't go to dances because he just want to hang out and watch The Matrix or something at his house by himself. I mean, just, you know what I mean? Like it was weird sometimes. That was what was hard. So when you left, it was just me and Chris, and we were like, and so getting him, he would go out, we would go to church dances and we would go to things, but getting him out to get into some mischief became insanely harder.
Wasn't it real?
Yeah, because like he was always the guy who didn't want to ruffle feather. I mean, he would, but like he was kind of a jerk like that. Like we would get in trouble together and then he would hide behind me when we got in trouble. You know what I mean? Like nobody would ever call his parents, you know, but they would go
online. Everybody was afraid of the Lord. His dad, you know. His dad was an insanely good guy. You know what I mean? Like but stern, you know, and
you didn't want to cross him.
You didn't want to mess with that man. And so I think Chris's thing was kind of, you know, he was the 9 out of 9 kids, right? His parents were a little bit older. And I think he just kind of was saying, you know what? It's just not worth it, right? That juice isn't worth the squeeze to mess with Lloyd Johnson.
Well, plus also the three or four kids that came before Chris were pretty wild. Like Randy was a nut. And so, you know, I think they were also a little more closed off with him because Randy ran hard himself. You know what I mean? And I loved him. I loved Randy Johnson with a passion. Like I would have loved to hang with that guy all the time. He was so much fun.
You know, I always just kind of looked up to Randy. He was always just like, he always just kind of like the epitome of cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he was also tough. I mean, he was strong. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And so you're like, hey, look, you can. Yeah. Well, I mean, Chris was too. I mean, Chris was faster than he should have been. I think it was the high socks, the gold toe high socks that was doing it for him.
Yeah. That was the other thing about Chris that was so interesting. Again, not super outgoing, but like he could pick up any sport. It drove me nuts because I had to work at basketball so hard. And if he had gone out for the team, he would have made it a question. He just didn't care.
That was the thing I never understood is he was so naturally gifted, but just didn't do it.
Yeah. He played baseball. He did that for a long time. And he played volleyball in high school, but as far as the big
three, he played, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I tried to get him to come out freshman year for the basketball team and he came to a couple practices. And I mean, he was like, strong rebounder could put, but I mean, he could have been good and he just didn't have the interest. And I was like, well, that kind of sucks, man. But like, so when you left though, that was the thing, you leave. And so it's just me and him. And we kind of tried to supplement the group, you know, cause it was really just us three. And then every once in a while, someone might run with us like a Nick Pilkington or something, but when we got to high school and you weren't there, it was me and him. And then, you know, Dave Grimsman came in and Gil Nunez came in, you know, and then Chris Harrison somehow got hooked in with us, which made things weird. fun, but weird.
Like, tell me more about that, John.
No, I think anybody who knew, I think anybody who's still going to Young Single Adult Dances knows what I'm talking about, but No, I loved Chris Garrison too. We just had a fun time. But when you left, the dynamic changed greatly. Maybe for the better. I don't know. Like we wouldn't.
Thank you.
I mean, because like, look, I think like we were on a trajectory to run real hard, you know, and so kind of splitting off and like you doing your own thing. It tapered us down quite a bit just because there's only one of us kind of pushing for the mischief instead of two, you know what I mean? And so, but when you're in Indy, so tell me about your high school experience.
Yeah. You know, high school was it was so weird. So, you know, there was 2,000 kids in Sacramento right at our high school. And then, you know, if you drove down the street, you know, 5 miles, there was another high school, and then another 5 miles, there was another high school. And it was just kids everywhere, right? And moved to Indiana, and there were 700 kids in the entire high school. And, you know, whereas back in Sacramento, like the schools all kind of melded together, right? Like, you know, whether you're at Del Campo or El Camino or San Juan or any of the other schools, like kids still kind of funneled together at the end of the day, whether it was church or sports or whatever. But Indiana was kind of interesting because, especially then, each school was, it's just, I mean, absolute, just, you went to Carmel, you hung out at Carmel. You went to Westville, you hung out at Westville. You went to Noblesville, you hung out at Noblesville. And, it was a real small town, you know what I mean? And when you're a lot of energy and used to a big space, like it was hard for me. So I graduated high school and I got out of Dodge real quick. I think I was 10 days after graduation, I moved to Arizona to be with my brother and to start going to school and working out there before I went on my mission.
You know, that's another thing that I found really interesting going back to us being together. This is another thing that I thought you and I had that maybe Chris necessarily didn't. And that is you and I were down to fight. You know what I mean? Like if somebody wanted to throw hands, I would say you even more than me were like down to go.
I got into a handful of fights growing up. Yeah.
And the funny thing is,
say something.
What's that?
What was that name? BJ. I'm trying to remember.
BJ Miller.
BJ Miller.
I remember. Cause I am not afraid to admit that I kind of stoked the flames of that. Cause I was super interested in seeing what happened.
Yeah, it's a shocker to everybody that you became a wrestling promoter later in life.
No, that was the thing. That was what I loved about you, too. What I loved hanging out with you is you were easy to get going. So yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, cause you were down to throw hands. There were a couple of times where we got into like there. You were with us at that Denny's when we got the big brawl Denny's. That was,
man.
Cops may have been called that night.
No, the cops were definitely called that
night. Excuse me. That was another reason why I loved hanging with you and why the dynamic changed. Because I'll tell you what, were you still around? You were around when Chris started dating Camille.
Honey, I was there. I was there for the first time he dated her, the second time he dated her.
Yeah, that happened about 47 times. But the thing is like during that, like there were dudes. I mean, like there were so many dudes Chris should have slapped, like that he just didn't. You know what I mean? And like, I loved Camille. She was one of my best friends when we were growing up, and I loved her and Chris together. But man, like that girl got hit on by every dude right in front of
me. Yeah.
And I was like, you know, I was like, I don't know why you're not, you know, because Chris could have. He was a scrappy dude. He could have dropped a guy, you know.
Chris was surprisingly strong. Like he was that wiry strong where if you got into it with him, you went, oh, I didn't see that coming, right? But he was super self-confident, super self-assured. So he wasn't real worried about that. I still remember, though, this is a fun story. So he was dating Camille. It was Christmas Day. And he was taking flowers over to her. So he said, hey, ride with me and my dad to go take these flowers. So Lowell had that small Toyota. Remember that little Toyota truck?
Yeah, right? Yeah, I do.
Big shift, right? and Chris is sitting in the middle, and I'm sitting on the outside, and he's got this big vase of flowers. And Lowell kind of intentionally like kind of pumps the brakes on him, and the water comes cresting over the side, and it splashes all over his knee. And Lowell looks at him and goes, well, your girlfriend's gonna think you peed your pants. He goes, and Chris, I mean, without missing, he goes, yeah, probably, but then she's going to get impressed that it's all the way down at my knee.
Oh, man. Yeah. Lowell and Sharon were so much fun because we used to mess with Chris so much. I remember there was a time where Sharon legitimately believed Chris was gay. And it wasn't for a long time, but there was a good amount of time where Clay Anderson and I had convinced her that he was definitely same sex attracted.
not that there's anything wrong with it.
That was funny, man. So
that prank worked in the 90s.
Yeah. like I said, the thing that was interesting is that you and I, we were down to do that. And so when you left, did you still, cause you got, like I said, you even more than me got into some real scraps. Did that continue to happen when you were in Indiana? Like, were you feeling a certain kind of way and did it act out that way?
You know, when I got to Indiana, I definitely still kept talking trash. But you know, as life has gone on, I've always had kind of a rule, two rules in general. Number one, don't fight wrestlers. Okay. And two, and two, never fight a man whose forearm and his wrist are roughly the same size. and there's a lot of those guys in Indiana. And so, you know, I got in a few scraps when I was here, but you know, I'm 6'6", 250 pounds now. And I think you're what, 6'8"?
Yeah, I'm 6'7".
And I mean, the thing was, we'll just put it that way. I could talk a lot of trash back when we were in California, because there weren't a lot of friends that were our size. Right. And so
Let me ask you a question about that, because I run into this all the time. In fact, like I said, I ran into a little bit. We went on that infamous trip to Chicago and South Bend and got in a little trouble out there. But like I find that when you're the biggest guy, if you hang around long enough, there's always someone trying to test you.
Oh, have you noticed that? All the time.
Like, yeah, there's some dude who, you know, especially if you're like I love live music, right? So I'll go out to bars and stuff like that just to hear 80s cover bands, 90 cover bands, you know, stuff like that. And like, yeah, if I'm there and the guy gets enough liquid courage in him, he'll come and try to mess with me. And I have to actively, like, sometimes I feel like I have to actively kind of be aware of my surroundings. I can tell who they are early in the night. Yeah. Yeah. The guys who are like super physical with their friends and always hugging and picking people up. I'm like, all right, that guy's going to be a problem around midnight. You know what I mean?
And oh, sure.
You see the same thing?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think at the end of the day, most guys like to kind of test themselves, right? And what better than to test yourself with the biggest guy in the room? And so, but I found as I've gotten older, it's a lot easier to buy somebody a beer than it is to get any dental work done. And so, you know, it doesn't bother me so much anymore. Plus, you know, for me, and this has really been true my whole life. Like, I've gotten into plenty of fights, but I usually don't get pissed off real quick, you know, anymore. I say anymore. But if you mess with someone I care about, I go from zero to a hero pretty quick. And that's about the only thing I think at this point that's going to draw me into a fight is if someone messed with one of my friends that I care about, I just have this like super protective gene in me that says, no, I love that person and I will take the punch. Let's go. Let's do this.
Yeah, man. And I mean, you definitely, and I think we all do, the three of us, but we all had like a loyalty to each other, even when we pissed each other off, which happened often.
To this day, Josh, if you and I were out together and someone, you know, went after me, I'd say, hey, let me buy you a beer. We probably had a misunderstanding. But if I saw someone go after you, I'd be like, buddy, I got a shovel and a bag of lye out in the car. You're not going to like where this leads.
Yeah, right. Yeah, man. Well, so, talk to me a little bit about what it was like in the 90s growing up with ADHD. Like, what did you feel kind of like? Because I think that now, like, learning disabilities, mental health issues, developmental issues, they're kind of more talked about and more understood. Back then, like you said, like ADHD was like a brand new thing.
So new.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really great comedy bit that somebody did one point. And they said, you know, nowadays we got dyslexia and ADHD, and we've got, you know, auditory issues and visual learning versus, you know, all these other things. And the guy goes, back in my day, we were just stupid. And it was hard. You know, it was almost shameful, right? Because you didn't understand the origin of it. You didn't understand why you had it. What's crazy is now is if you read about it, if you watch videos about it, you just kind of all of a sudden go, wow, that's me identified. And so my wife and I, in fact, about a year ago, you know, we don't get into these big knockdown, drag out fights at all. We will get into like these like kind of slow burning, ongoing, like this is annoying me type fights, right? And I kept trying to explain to her, saying, honey, I'm giving you the best of what I have. I'm sorry if it's not enough. And finally, we got a book that was, you know, ADHD in your marriage. And we got about two chapters in, and the whole narrative changed in my relationship with her. She was like, this really is just kind of at your core who you are, isn't it? I said, yes, I'm trying to act. I recognize it. So I try and change it, right? But in the 90s, I mean, nobody knew why I acted the way I act, least of all me. And then back then they had Ritalin. They didn't have, you know, the much better, more dialed in stuff. And so you'd almost go and take this medicine and your whole personality would change. And for everybody else that was around you, it was great because you were no longer bouncing off of walls. But for you, you just felt like you were basically comatose. And so it was this terrible combination of recognizing that you were wearing people thin while at the same time not feeling like yourself.
You know, that was what was so interesting, though, is that I know that there were people who thought that, but I never got that from you. Like, I was never, I don't remember ever being like, that's enough of Brian. You know what I mean? Like,
I'll give you a compliment in that space. And here's what it is. The people I get along best with, even now in my 40s, are people who are really intelligent and who just kind of can recognize and go, oh, this isn't who he is. This is just kind of a mechanism within his personality. And because they see that and they understand who I am, they go, okay, it's no different than someone who's got, like, you know, a tic or Tourette's or something, but they go, this is a good person. He's got a medical issue, but that doesn't diminish his value as a human. And you saw that, Chris saw that. And so that's why I was always super loyal to you guys, because you never made me feel less than. You always made me feel like I was part of the crew.
Yeah. Well, you were, man. We had our crew, and that was, we ran together. It was kind of like a us against the world kind of thing, at least for me. Cause I came in, you know, I was just grateful you guys hung with me, because, you know, I moved in end of fifth grade, early sixth grade. Yeah. Like, I didn't have any friends really in elementary school. I didn't have the time to build those friendships. And So I was just grateful that, like, you guys lived down the street, and I was like, it was easy. I didn't have to hang out at home by myself, you know? And so we all just kind of became inseparable. And that was like, it was so meaningful. I tell my son now, you know, he's 17, and we were joking about this. We were both kind of saying earlier when we were talking about doing this, I was like, if we had the confidence in ourselves that we have now, back then, like, we life would have been drastically different, probably not for the best. Because I mean, like, we did fine. You know what I mean? Like, when it came we did okay despite our lack of confidence. But, you know, yeah, there would have been definitely a, you know, I'd have a kid who's 30 and something itchy if I wasn't careful. So like, you know, I just, because of the kind normal of, but that was a thing. What's that?
Does this look normal, Doc?
but he though, you know, my son, dude, I mean, like, 6'3", blonde hair, blue eyes, goes to the gym every day, super athletic, plays the guitar, sings like an angel. Like, the kid has it all. You know what I mean? Yeah. And he's got the confidence to boot. Everybody, I mean, he's just, everybody loves him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's just,
yeah.
Yeah. And so, I was telling him, you know, cause he's graduating high school, and he's got a couple of friends that come to the house that I really like. And, you know, they're just kind of like, they're like his Chris and Brian, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I tell him, I'm like, and he's got one, you know, I won't say who, but he's got, you know, one of them that is a little out there, you know, and I love him to death. He reminds me of us so much. I just go, oh, this guy's great. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, no, I don't want you necessarily going out with him after midnight, but I mean, like, he's, you know, he's a good kid. And, but I tell him, I'm like, man, just all these friends you have, just know there's only a couple of them that you're really going to remember, and you just got to keep them. It's probably a little different for them because they had cell phones and they have Facebook and all that stuff, you know, but it's, it was a special
time. You make a good point, though. So I always, I taught my kids this kind of important lesson of life, which is, I say, pay attention to the people that would be in the first two or three rows at your funeral. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of people that will come and go from your life, right? But, you know, the people whose life would really change and diminish if you weren't in it, those are the people that you stay close to. Because everybody else is great for background characters, but there are people in your life who go, no, this is my people. And I look at our childhood, I look at when we grew up, like, you know, I was number four or six, you were the oldest, and Chris was the youngest, right? And, you know, you had some interesting upbringing moments, and I won't go into all the details because it's not my story to share. But Chris was, you know, kind of by himself in that house, and you had some interesting experiences, and I was number 4 out of 6. And I think, especially back then, like, I had all the siblings and we're pretty solid. And so we really piecemealed together kind of really good, like larger scale family between all of us. You know what I mean? Where we had the older siblings, we had the younger siblings, we had, you know, the parents that were struggling, we had the parents who were older, we had the parents who were just trying to keep their head above water, right?
Yeah.
And none of us had that, like, Brady Bunch or Leave It to Beaver, like, you know, type of upbringing or parents or household. And yet, I think all of us came out of that, like, just looking for a sense of, like, belonging and family, and we found it.
Yeah. Well, that's what it was so interesting about that time. And when you moved, you know, it was, like I said earlier, like, it really changed the dynamic of our group significantly. And and so now you mentioned something. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about ADHD. Sure. So now you're a father of 3.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
How is it parenting as a parent with ADHD?
Yeah.
Does it change anything or how it affects you?
The good news is I'm so tired at this point that the ADHD keeps me going. I think the thing for me is this is my wife is very stable, like just steady Eddie. I don't know anybody who can focus the way she can focus and kind of stay in the pocket, right? But what she's always looked for, people who can pull her out of that shell. And when it comes to the kids, my oldest is a very atypical, oldest, successful, driven, but compassionate and caring human being. And my son is, I think, your typical teenage boy, right? Like, there are things he cares about and things he doesn't. But what's really interesting for me is that I have a daughter. My youngest is super, super ADHD. And you know, I get a little weepy when I talk about it, so you have to forgive me. She's such a good kid. And I see the struggle she goes through. But what's really been great for me is that I get to help her understand the why of what she's experiencing. And I get to help her understand how to navigate those waters better than I did, because my parents didn't have the knowledge. They didn't have the firsthand account experience. They had a couple of articles that were out there, but for me, it's great because what it's really done is validated the close relationships I have in my life to realize that people love me not in spite of my ADHD, but in many cases because of my ADHD. Because they know, oh, this guy's super sweet. He's super endearing. He'll give you the shirt off his back. He'll help you with anything. And the reason I know that is because I see the way they talk to her. They see the way they interact with her. My adult friends look at her and go, oh my God, she's the best kid I've ever met. She's so sweet and she'll do anything. And then the next, you know, she comes out of the room wearing a leotard with her hair in a ponytail and like dinosaur Crocs on. You go, what the hell is this? I probably wore something like that at different points, you know?
Oh, yeah. We dressed you up like that quite a bit.
Well, I remember the face tattoos you guys gave me when I fell asleep.
You shouldn't have fell asleep, man. You knew the rules.
Play the game, you know the rules, this is what happens. But you know, it's actually really cool because in moments where you just go, we're frustrated, we're tired, we're this, we're that, the other, I have been able to create, at least in my mind, some really fun experiences with the kids, you know, from, hey, it's Friday night and there's nothing going on and they were little, I've got this stupid projector from work. Let's go put a movie on the garage door. And at one point it was, you know, me and my 3 kids. And then It grew to where we had probably 40 or 50 people in my driveway with lawn chairs watching Pirates of the Caribbean one night, right? And the ability to have that ADHD just says, yeah, screw it, bring more people in. And I've always created because in some of those moments of loneliness that you feel when you feel isolated, I've always had a big tent mentality to say, everybody's welcome, you know? And it's super cool to see my daughter have the exact same thing. And I have a friend of mine that looked at me, she goes, oh my God, she is exactly like you. And there are times where I'll start bouncing off the wall, you know, I'm having fun. And a buddy of mine will go, hey, Selena, rein it in a little bit, huh?
Yeah, man. But the thing is, though, is like I said, like that kind of energy, though, man, like when, you know, when we would go out together, that energy was a lot of fun. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. And you always did have a good heart and you always did care. You were always an emotional person when it came to the people you loved. And so it's really cool to hear you. We don't often talk about our kids like that. I'm the same way. Like being a parent is the greatest, most difficult thing you'll ever do.
Oh my God. There are days where you show, are you ever going to turn 18? And there are other days where I'm like, please stop aging. You know what I mean?
Oh man. I just recently, you know, I think you know this, I'm sure you followed. I went to WrestleMania weekend with my boys.
I saw that.
And it was a great vacation, but it struck me, you know, my son is graduating and I just, you know, the relationship, we'll always have a good relationship, but like, it just hit me. I was like, this is it. This is the last time that he's going to be like this with me. And we have a great relationship. Like just today, I was talking, I was in the middle of work and he calls me and he just, you know, he's like, hey, I'm going to go, you know, we talked about, he needs a new suit.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, and he has senior ball coming up and all this stuff. And so we were talking about going and trying on suits and he called me and he just goes, hey dad, my two buddies, they're going right now to go try on suits and I want to go with them, but I know that I told you I'd go with you. So if you want me to go with you, I'll go with you.
Yeah.
And I was so gratefully called and I just go, hey man, like this is a thing for you and your friends. So a
little rite of passage, right?
Yeah, I was like, go have fun with your friends and we'll, you know, I was like, go have fun with your friends and we'll, you know, just get your measurements. And when it's time to go pay for it, I'll just go and I'll see, you know, try it on in front of me and we'll, you know, we'll pay for it and go. And so I know that we have a good relationship just on the fact that he did that, you know, that he cares enough to do that. Cause I certainly didn't when I was his age, you know,
Let me ask you, started waking up or did you get to a point where you'd wake up in the middle of the night, like that rollover and you have like a mini panic attack at 3 a.m. where it's like, oh man, my kids are getting older. They're going to be out of the house soon.
No, not really. You know, I've not had that, but it's kind of creeped up on me, man, because like life is so busy for me. I mean, sure it is for you too, but like it's so busy. And this has been the funnest time for me to watch them grow. I think it's just now hitting me now that Austin is going to be graduating that I'm just like, oh my gosh, like they're starting to leave.
Yeah.
Right. You know, he's, you know, he's got a plan. He'll stick around for a year. He's going to stay with, you know, stay here and go a year to community college and then serve a mission. And then when he comes back from his mission, he'll decide what he wants to do from there. But I'm like, man, like it just, we've kind of had conversations with him and he's a stud. I mean, he's just, he really just kind of came into his own this year. And so, but like, you know, talking to him, just going like, dude, our relationship just, it kind of naturally changes now. Like you're an adult, right? Like I'm not holding your hand anymore. You can come to me for advice, but you have to come to me. Like I'm not going to be
right.
You know what I mean? And, yeah. And I think he's taken to that, pretty well. So, yeah. But no, yeah. There are, I don't think they understand though, to your point, I don't think they understand how much we really worry about them.
You know, I remember my oldest was born, right? So she's 17 and a half. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, I'm number 4 out of 6 kids. I was the second one to get married, but I was the first one to have children. Right. Mm-hmm. And in that order, by the way, I think that was the big surprise of everybody that I actually waited to have kids until after I got married. but I remember laying eyes on her the first time and thinking, oh my God, do my parents love me the way I love this? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that changed my relationship with my parents in a lot of ways. But, you know, for me, the panic was I graduated high school and, you know, said about 10 days later, I was on the road to Arizona with my older brother. And this is, cell phones were just starting to thing. And a year later, you know, I was off to Argentina for a 2-year mission. And then I got home and inside of 18 months, I was married. And so life came at me pretty fast and in short order. And, I would wake up at 3 a.m, just panic attacks. Like, my kids are getting older. This is the last couple of years. I'm even going to have them in my life like this. And I was expressing that to a friend and they said, well, why say that? And I kind of went through my story and they said, well, you know, your parents, are they pretty active in your life? I said, you know, not as much as I think anybody would love their parents to be in their life. Right. But they have 6 kids. They got a lot going on. They're older. But they said, you know, your parents grew up in a time where you would literally leave the house, might write letters once a month or so. You might call if it was a special occasion, but you were still paying, you know, 10 cents a minute to call long distance. Right? And like, that was the expectation. I mean, they were raised by parents who went off to, you know, World War II type scenarios. Right. And like, you left and you were gone. And that's the example they saw. And I said, is that what you're going to do with your kids? Or when they graduate high school, go to college, are you going to kind of fade into the shadows? I said, hell no, I'm, you know, I'm going to be there. I'm going to be involved. I'm going to be this. They said, then stop panicking that your relationship is ending and get on board with the idea that your relationship is evolving. Yeah. Like, oh. You know, and that helped. After that, I stopped waking up in the middle of the night.
That's interesting. Now let's transition to another thing. You mentioned your mission and, you know, I was at your wedding, in the temple and, I think your wedding was the last time that, you and I had seen each other until you, Chris, and I all went on that trip to the Notre Dame football game, which was like 10 years in the making.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, I came out, you know, you'd heard about my circumstances, invited me to come out for a weekend.
Yeah.
Which was exactly what I needed. But, And that was when you kind of shared with me that you had kind of taken your faith journey had led you away from the church. Yeah. And I have to tell you, that was we took a drive from Carmel, Indiana, to Chicago for the Cubs game. And that 3.5-hour trip, for me, that changed my perspective significantly on people leaving the church.
In what way?
I think I was your typical in the box member of the church before then, where I kind of had this view that people who leave the church are leaving because maybe there's some secret sin they're hiding, or that they're just looking for an excuse, or maybe they were offended, and not necessarily because they've come out with a different view. Of the gospel, or that it was a struggle. And the conversation we had, because at the beginning I felt like I was kind of like, first of all, I was shocked, right? I was really surprised, because we'd never really had the conversation before. Yeah. And I think the conversation came up because you were like, just FYI, going out tonight, you're going to see a different side of Brian. And I was like, what do you mean? But you really poured, you had enough time to really help me process what you were saying and understand where you were coming from. And so maybe you can kind of share a snapshot of your journey from, cause I mean, dude, we were all tried and true, served missions.
Oh yeah.
We all, you know, marriage in the temple, you know,
a big point of pride for you and I and Chris was that regardless or people thought about us, whatever they thought they knew about us. Oh, those boys are getting our troublemakers. They're not the type of boys you want dating your daughter, whatever that, you know, reputation we had back then was.
But just so you guys know, we dated all your daughters.
And we only dated them harder. Yeah. You know, all three of us followed through on our commitment that we said, we're going to go out, we're going to do a 2-year mission trip. All three of us said, hey, our goal is to be married in an LDS temple. And we all did it. Yeah. And for me, you know, that transition or anything was I think my feelings evolved in terms of Christianity and care and focus on the sinner, not the sin. And I want to be clear, I don't have any animosity or any ill will towards the church or its members by any means. You know, I think that I think there are people that leave that are bitter at times, but that's not everyone. And I think there are people that leave because they do things that aren't in keeping with the church's standards. But again, not everyone. You know, for me, it was a situation where I just kind of looked at the world and kind of went, you know, here's a fun thing that happened one time when I was in a singles ward. You know, oftentimes you hear like, if for those of you that aren't LDS or don't know about it, like the church once a month kind of has an open mic, if you will. And it's a opportunity for people to just express their feelings and their gratitude for Jesus and the teachings of Jesus and the church and what it's meant to them. And so oftentimes you hear people say, I just don't know where I'd be without the church. You know, I'd probably be a drug addict or I'd probably be an alcoholic. And I always said, if the church is the only thing that's keeping you from beating your wife and cheating on her and, you know, abandoning your family, then you're probably not, you know, wired the right way to start with, right? Like that shouldn't be the reason why you're not doing it. Although I was in a singles ward one time when a girl got up and said, I'd probably be addicted to drugs and prostituting myself and sleeping in the streets, just like my twin sister.
And you're like, I gotta hang with this chick.
You got her number? I met so many good people that along the way that didn't subscribe to the Mormon church, that didn't do those things, and yet were really, really great, excellent people. And you know, without going too deep into the doctrinal differences and everything else, I just got to a point where I said, there are certain things that I just really didn't agree with any longer. Stances that the church had taken that I said, that's not really serving to me the best interests of kind of what the humanity is. And again, I had a church leader come by one time and kind of invite me to come back. And I just told him, I said, hey, look, I said, I love you and I appreciate you coming here. I really do. I said, but if the Lord's going to sort out all of us afterwards anyways and kind of say, hey, here's where the misunderstandings, where's where things are right now. My understanding is X. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. But that's also part of what, you know, the church teaches the atonement is for. And Jesus is sacrificed to say, hey, for when you have a misunderstanding, for when you have a mistake, for when you commit sin, you know, that the knowledge that we're not perfect beings, that, that is there to make up our shortcomings. And if this is a shortcoming of mine, so be it, you know. But I also feel like since leaving the church and not putting the restraints on that, you can only love people as long as they're following certain gospel principles, or you can only associate with them given certain principles. I go, that really doesn't jive with me. You know, Jesus, from the scriptures, hung out with some people that had some problems, hung out with some people that had some issues. And there's times where we all try to out-Christian one another. We all try to out-Mormon one another by saying, I'm only hanging out with people who also live and believe exactly what I do. And then you end up in a bit of an echo chamber when that happens, where it's all just kind of self-defeating, that you never really get to know people. And then you never really are changed by their story either, because you're only hoping that they'll be changed by yours. And so to me, it was an opportunity for me to kind of grow and continue. And I was terrified, to be honest with you. I was just absolutely terrified leaving the church in the beginning. I didn't know what was going to happen to my wife, my children. I didn't know if, you know, I was making this monumental mistake that was going to just hurt them in the long run. And when it was all said and done, we've grown closer as a family. I had a better marriage because of it. I'm not going to say that, hey, if you lead the church, your marriage will get better too. That's not the case for everybody. That's not a guarantee for anybody one way or the other. It's also not a guarantee that it'll be better for staying. But what was really special to me was that my wife stood by me the whole time. And she even asked in the beginning, said, well, I still want to go. Are you willing to go for the kids and for me? I said, absolutely, 100%. And we just got to a point where we kind of said, as a family, you know, do we want to be in this space, or what space do we in? And eventually we got to a spot where we said, there's a lot to life and a lot of good people out there that we can help and we can support. And at times, you know, the sticker of saying I'm an LDS member was getting in the way of that.
So why do you think that is? Like you said a few things in there. You're like, well, I don't want to only associate with members, and you don't feel like maybe because you're LDS, you couldn't associate with some people. Yeah. And that has just never been my experience. But then again, I live in California where everybody's kind of a little more open to those things. So tell me a little bit more about that.
I think it's for the best reasons. I don't think it's for any kind of malady that people are saying only associate with other members of the church. I think it's a fear issue, if I'm being really candid. I think, you know, like they talk about as you age, like religion is a sleeper topic. I still remember this from a sociology class I took, that they said, you know, you get older, certain things become more important, and religion is one of them, because you basically are saying, hey, I'm getting closer to meeting Jesus, and I want to make sure I kind of line things up. And fear has a way of impeding people in ways that other things don't. And I think, you know, the concept of love the sinner, but not the sin, leaves a lot of room for interpretation. And some people choose fear or allow fear to get in the way of loving the sinner without loving the sin.
And there are you talking about, just so I'm clear, like for example, some person might fear, say, someone in the LGBTQ community or something because of who they are, and be afraid of, who they are, and so not associate with someone in that group.
Yeah, they might not have. I mean, there's, but like I said, I try not to point to too many specifics and factors. There was some comments that were made at a church general conference that talked about the fact that, you know, if you have a child that's of the LGBTQ, you know, community, that it's okay to tell them they're not allowed to stay in your home, that it's okay to say that you're not going to introduce them to your friends. It's okay to say that you're not accepting of their lifestyle and who they are in that space. And I thought, this is my child. Of course I'm going to accept them regardless. You know, shy of my kid murdering somebody, I can't imagine something that they could do, really, that I would go, well, I'm just not going to stand by your side any longer. Right. You know, and, you know, when you look at it from that perspective, it just kind of is counter to the point of like families are forever, and our hope that we want to stay together forever. And there's certain things in that space that people were really hurt, emotionally hurt by things. You know, the people talk about the November policy of basically saying that you had to disavow your parents' decision if you were the child of an LGBTQ person and had to say, no, I agree that what they're doing is bad and wrong, and I'm never going to allow anybody to believe that I'm accepting of that. And I went, you know, I think that's an overzealous point that people are making, that if we believe that each of our own decisions are ours, and that I'm not being judged for your sins any more than you're being judged for mine, then who am I to sit there and tell you I won't associate with you, and I won't let your kids play with my kids, or I won't be in a space where I introduce you as a very dear friend of mine if you came out as a homosexual or as a lesbian or whatever you happen to be. And at the end of the day, everybody's journey is their own. And you know, I really kind of boiled down my life to three basic rules. And one of them is that everybody is dealing with things that they're not ready to talk about in public. And we could all just be, if we could just be kind to one another, we could solve a lot of problems and ease a lot of problems, you know?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I have been put in a kind of a strange position. I think part of it has to do with my podcast. Some of it has to do with my own personal life experience that I don't share publicly. But I've been both fortunate and unfortunate to hear of a lot of people in a lot of circumstances for various reasons. It's actually made me learn quite a bit that everything can look good on the outside and there's still something rotting on the inside. And that actually is pretty common more often than not. Something really struggling, and you just don't know when you say the wrong thing or you say something as sarcastic wit that maybe would be hurtful. I remember one time when I was a kid, I used to make fun of a friend of mine's cousin was around, and we used to razz each other, and I went a little hard on her. And it wasn't until later that I realized she told me I actually went into the bathroom and cried.
Yeah,
because of all the stuff you were saying. And it struck me. I was like, oh man, like I'm a dick, you know? And so, yeah, man, like there's so much out there and also there's so many people out there that are good people that don't necessarily align perfectly. But you can still love them. I mean, I know you and I are different in that I still go to church and I still sure. Faithful, you know, member, but I agree with a lot of what you're saying, and I wish culturally we weren't dealing with that as much. Before we go on, there's something else I wanted to ask you about that. One thing that I found was really interesting is that we had a good conversation when we were in that car. You were talking about relationships being affected. Talk to me about how relationships with like friends in your ward or even your family, how that was affected by your decision to leave and how that affected you.
Yeah. You know, again, this I don't think that this is a church policy. It's much it was. I think everybody just lives super busy lives, and the concept of out of sight, out of mind is a very real thing. And we always joked around in our house that the Mormon mafia is the connections run deep, and so but part of that is that you have to be present to connect with people, right? And as we stopped going, there were friends of ours that we had that were very dear friends. I mean, people who had miscarriages that would call my wife and say, I can you please come over? Wouldn't let anybody else into the home but my wife. And my wife would sit there in the dark and rub her back and help her out. Or friends that you know would show up late at night to help me. I'd show up late at night to help them. And we were there for one another. And as we got out of the church, it was almost an overnight pull the rug out from under us type of moment where they were gone. They just weren't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And my wife even had a sit down with a couple of her friends and said, hey, like, I don't know what's going on, but like, you know, I'm reaching out. You're not reaching back. Or I see on Facebook and social media that you're out there doing these things. And these are things we did together. And I would love to still do those with you. And the response was, well, we never thought we were that good of friends.
Hmm.
And I went, okay. So So the question is, were we friends based on friendship, you know, and underlying principles, or is this just circumstantial that we were in the same spot at the same time, and so we decided then to make a run at being friends? And that was super hurtful. You know what I mean? I mean, super hurtful. Because you know, you have these shared moments and then they're just gone. And something I talk to people about all the time was, like I said, like, you know, you and Chris were gone all of a sudden. You were out of my life. And, you know, I left before Facebook. I left before social media. I left before cell phones and texting. So for me, it was almost like I did die. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I would try and track you guys down on a phone call. Like, oh, well, they're out. Oh, they're not home right now. They're doing this. They're doing that. And it's like, okay, well, try them again. And you know, you're playing pin the tail on the donkey, hoping to catch them at the right moment, you know?
And I tell my kids about that all the time, about how like hard it was to get a hold of people and go do things, you know,
right.
back then.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the good news for my wife and I is that we have since found people that we have brought into our lives who are very, very dear to us and whose friendship is not dependent upon a shared religion, but a shared sense of values. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
That's been really kind of cool to see that, like, you can have a difference of opinion without having a difference of like, well, you need to do this, otherwise we can't be friends.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was funny because I remember having a conversation with somebody. I came back from that trip and I was with a buddy of mine and I was kind of sharing because you had said, I remember it struck me quite hard when you said, as soon as I stopped coming to church, the phone call stopped.
Yep.
And I said that to him and I remember him saying, well, yeah, because you know, like if you're not going to church anymore, like you don't have a lot in common. And I was like, I don't know of anybody that I'm friends with only because they're a member of the church.
But see, I think that's why you and I got along so well, is that wasn't why we were friends. We were friends because we had common interests. We had fun together. Like we grew up in the same neighborhood. We grew up going to the same schools. We grew up talking to the same people, playing the same sports. And the church was a sliver of that. And then for some people that sliver grows to become their entire personality.
Yeah. And that becomes a problem. You know, I think that that's a problem in any relationship that you have. Is I remember hearing a friend of mine talk about someone from my mission, a female I knew from the mission. She was on a podcast with another friend of mine from the mission, and she was talking about the end of her marriage. And she was saying, you know, she was active, and her husband decided to not be active. And she said that she realized that her and her husband, the only things that they had in common were physical attraction and spiritual attraction, meaning they were attracted because they both were church members and they both are physically attracted to each other. But as you know, no knock on anybody, you know, you and I were still strapping young men, but you know, as you get to be in your 30s and 40s, you know, your bodies change and you know, attraction changes. So if all you have is physical attraction and spiritual attraction and one person, you know, those aren't there anymore and you don't have any common interests, it poses a real problem.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting because I was really scared. I mean, I was really, really scared. I will tell you this. While the church doesn't come out and say if one spouse decides to leave the church and the other one wants to stay, the church doesn't tell you, oh, get divorced and leave each other. That's not in the official documents. I can tell you that I've been part of enough conversations in hallways and in closed-door meetings where local leadership, not necessarily leadership from headquarters out in Salt Lake, but local leadership, have expressed the thought that it might be for some people to get divorced. So that way the member or the spouse that wants to remain a member can then potentially get remarried to somebody who also wants to be a member of the church. You know, I was really scared because at one point, you know, my wife thought I was cheating on her and couldn't be further from the truth, but it was because my personality. Like, I'm loud. I like to have fun. I'm gregarious. Like, I like to have a good time, and I don't necessarily hold a lot of things in. You know, I talk, if something's on my mind, I talk about it. But there was a 6-month stretch where I wasn't really talking. I wasn't sharing my thoughts. I wasn't going over what was bothering me. And she just point blank asked, she goes, "Are you cheating on me?" I said, "No, of course not." But it nothing really made sense to her. The last thing on her mind was that I would say I didn't want to be a member of the church anymore, right? I mean, I had had stake leadership callings. I had had, you know, someone needed something. I was the first guy in line to say, "Yep, I'll do it. I can help." And so I finally kind of broke down and told her, I said, "Well, I just, if you're going to leave me either way, I just want you to know that it's not that I'm cheating on you. I don't want to poison the well for other relationships you might have. I just don't know that I want to be a member of the church anymore." And to her credit, she looked at me and she goes, "Well, that's it." Now I'm going to cut you right here, right now, if you say that to me. You know, yeah. I was so scared. And well, kind of goes back to that fear that I talked about earlier, right? Mm-hmm. That, people are afraid of a lot of things, and losing control is one of them. And, you know, I said I have 3 rules to life. And the first rule I told you is that people are dealing with stuff they're not ready to talk about. The second rule I have is, you know, whatever world religion you're part of, if you're part of one, whatever that happens to be, you have faith and hope in it, right? And I always say that hope is easily defined as this is what you want to have happen. And faith is how much you believe that thing is going to happen, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And while I still maintain hope that there is an eternity and that there is a place beyond this life that I can spend with my wife and children, my faith in the certainty of that is probably waned quite a bit. You know, and I go, I don't know. I don't know that that is a for certain thing. And for someone to say, "Oh, I know," I would say, "Well, I think what you mean is you believe, you have faith that that's the case." But nobody really knows aside from Jesus. And again, I will say this allegedly, because he's the only person that is documented as to have died and come back to life, right? And come back from the grave. Outside of Jesus, nobody else has really experienced that. So we all just have a belief in that thing, but we don't know. And because we don't, my rule is try not to judge so harshly about what gives people comfort.
Yeah. Do you, would you describe yourself then now as agnostic? What would you describe yourself as now?
I think I'm probably fall more in the category of agnostic. You know, I hope that there is something beyond this, but I would tell you that I struggle with the concept that if, you know, the traditional Judeo-Christian belief is that, you know, God is the father of all, right? And there's 7 billion people on the earth. There are certain things that I struggle with, and I'm sure someone could easily explain away and say, "Oh, well, here's why you feel this way or that." But I go, I struggle with the concept that God is answering the prayers of some person who lost their car keys and not answering the prayers of the kid that's just trying to get clean water in Africa. You know? And so I typically tell people, I go, "I'm not telling you that there's not a God. I'm just telling you that if that scenario is true and plays out, that there's probably a lot about God that we just simply don't understand and that we don't know. He might be different than what we think."
It may be. I think there's also a question of how much intervention in our lives does God truly do? Right. Like you mentioned, right, the prayers and how much of this was set in motion and how much of this is really, like you mentioned, like the starvation of kids in Africa. How much of that is really man-made versus God-made? How much of this is, you know, we're all so interconnected. There's a great book. I had a guy on the podcast named Patrick Mason who talks about all of the things that truly do affect your free agency, even just down to the fact that, you know, if you believe in Mormon doctrine, you were created as an intelligence and then later you were changed to being a you know, a spirit being and then go through the veil. And then on top of it, there's all sorts of environmental issues like DNA and learning disabilities, you know, like ADHD and things that affect your free agency. It's really, it's going to be fascinating getting there and really figuring out what this is all about.
Yeah. And I think you're spot on that. At the end of the day, like I said, fear has a way of controlling people. And then that fear says that if you do this, you're okay. If you don't do this, you're not. And I just think that things are probably a lot more different than what we realize. And that if there is God and he's out there, that he must be extraordinarily compassionate for all of us. Because I think at the end of the day, there is just so much that we're hoping and assuming is true. And that we're doing our best in that space to kind of follow through on that. But my favorite scripture from then and my favorite scripture now, even as a non-believer, so to say, or as an agnostic, is that, the Pharisees came to Jesus and asked him, said, "Master, of all the commandments, which is the greatest of all?" He said, "Well, the first is love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, might, mind, and strength." And he said, "The second is like unto it, you know, love thy neighbor as thyself." And what I told people then and what I tell people now is that our failure to love our neighbor as ourselves is why we have so much problems in this world. That if you were hungry, you would eat. But you see your neighbor starving and you think, well, they did this to themselves. Even if they did, why wouldn't you still help them?
Well, I agree with you on that. And I want to twist gears because I know you're 3 hours ahead of me, or two hours ahead of me, but I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about your newfound passion, or maybe it's not newfound, but new to me, of stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, I got to be honest with you. When you first told me you were going to do stand-up comedy, I was a tad skeptical.
Okay.
I was like, okay, so I know Brian can be funny, but I don't know if he can be funny on purpose. All the time. You know what I mean? Because you had comedy, but a lot of it was not prepared comedy, if that made sense.
Sure.
And sure. So, but then you started sending me clips.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I like, you know, I've gone to a lot of comedy shows, right?
Yeah.
Including like open mics and local stuff.
Yep.
And I'm like, because my brother is really was really heavy into it for a while. And I remember going, this is above average for like guys just starting out. Like you were clearly very quickly above average for your typical open micer. Right.
You know,
it's been fun. Yeah. So where did it come from and when did you start writing material and when did you finally decide you were going to try it out?
Yeah. That's a good question. So as a kid, my dad was always very liked by everybody who ever engaged with him. And people, he always had a joke at the ready. He always had a funny comment. He always put people at ease by making them laugh. And, my personality with ADHD, a lot of what I tell people is I kind of had a slower start to life in that space of kind of reading social situations. But I always knew that if people laugh, they usually liked the person that made them laugh. And so I always would try and find ways to make people chuckle. You know what I mean? I always thought, well, that's my end. And as I said earlier, you know, my sense of humor and my sense of values don't always line up. And so what I tell people is that if you can believe, if you can go to the movies for 2 hours and believe that sentient robots came to space to fight other sentient robots here and transform into 18-wheel trucks, then I can make some jokes that might not love, but can just be funny, right? And it's a hell of a creative outlet for me. And so about the same time that I was getting out of the church and saying, I'm gonna put that on hold for a minute, I said, well, at some point I would love to do stand-up. And so what I did is I actually opened up a separate email account. And anytime something kind of humorous would happen, any kind of, you know, natural blunder I encountered in my own life, I would just write a note and kind of like journal it, right? And I put it off to the side and say, yep, this happened. And so my wife had been encouraging me almost since we got married to say, you should go do stand-up. You should try it. And so finally, about 6 months ago, I said, you know, if I don't do it now, it's never going to happen. And so I got up some courage, had some extremely supportive friends, and went out and started doing open mics. And, you know, I would say that I've been very fortunate that I found some really good people that I took some classes to kind of help me understand joke structure and, like, when you're doing stand-up, how to do it, and start helping me write things. And in short order, I went from an open mic guy that only performs, you know, like 5 minutes here and there, to now I do like the weekend. Like, the big jump is to get into weekend work where people are like performing, not just at like a bar, but at a club. So I'm kind of a regular at a comedy club here in downtown Indianapolis called Crackers. I just hosted over the weekend. They called me, they had a different host that was lined up, and then they called me last minute and said, hey, in about 2 hours, we got a show. Can you come do 15 minutes and then be the host for the whole show for the weekend? I went, yeah, let's go. So it's been pretty awesome to make that jump. And I did do a show. I was probably about a month in. It's probably too early, but it was a contest up in South Bend, Indiana. And there's probably 100 people in the room, and I was the only white guy that was there. And as I jokingly say, I go, you know, I love performing for people that aren't white. You know, it's predominantly a black crowd. And I said, I kind of opened up. I said, I think it was the seventh comedian out of eight to go up. And I said, you know, a lot of people said a lot of things about white people in here. I said, I want to be really clear about something. I don't like them any more than you do. And you know, but the good news is I will talk to the cops for all of us. And yeah. And from that moment on, you know, the rest of my set, everybody just had a good time with me. They said, all right, this is a decent guy. And it's that type of putting people at ease that I just love doing it, you know?
Catching people. That's awesome. So what is your ultimate goal? I mean, are you going to try to really make a go of this, or is it just kind of a hobby?
You know, it was funny because my wife asked me the same question. So, okay, so you're going to do this. Is this just something you want to kind of putz around with for a while, or what do you want to do? And at first it was, yeah, you know, I just want to do this for me. And then, you know, I've gotten paid for a couple of gigs now. So it's, you know, money in the beginning is obviously not great. You know, nobody, Netflix isn't calling me yet to say, hey, can you do a special? Right. But, you know, the long-term goal for me at this point is really that I get good enough that I can become a regional comic and do, you know, 20, 30 minute sets. Like, if there's a show going on in Chicago, they say, hey, call Brian Rod, get him to come up here, see if he's available for the weekend. And then as my wife and I get to retirement, we love traveling. Right. And so we said, wouldn't it be fun if in retirement we could say, hey, there's a show in St. Louis. And then the following weekend, I'm doing a show in Florida. And then the following weekend after that, there's one over in New York. And so, you know, we just kind of travel around, meet some interesting people, have some fun and some laughs and kind of have a go at it. And if things go bigger than that, great. And if they never get to that point, yeah, my self-esteem and self-image isn't dependent upon me getting a Netflix deal anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, that's the same way I've been, you know, with this podcast and even with like wrestling and stuff like that. It's always been a situation. It's like, listen, I'm doing this for me. And if other people are listening, cool, you know, but if they're not, like, I get to have cool conversations like this with you and just, you know, and awesome. Do a lot of cool, fun things. And, you know, I'm making memories with it. So I think it's cool. You're kind of doing the same thing.
Well, we get to my third rule of life now, which is I always ask people, I go, you know, can you tell me 3 weeks ago tonight what you were doing? And more times than not, they go, no clue. I say, how about 2 weeks ago? You remember it? And then you finally get to the point, I go, do you remember like 3 nights ago what you were doing? And again, we're all so busy. They go, I don't know, man. I don't know what I was doing. They go, right. That's the point, is that we're probably not going to remember this moment in time either. Not unless one of us does something extraordinary, right? Right. And so if that's the case, why not just try and enjoy the moment you're in and be happy? Why, you know, you can't put happiness in the bank and then pull it out later. You either enjoy it while it's there or you don't.
Right.
So we're all just surfing this timeline. You got to try and enjoy it while you're in it.
Man, that's good advice. But listen, let me ask you, as we wrap up, I want to give you the three questions I ask everybody.
Sure.
Okay. So I'm going to throw these out at you. First, what would you say is your biggest success in life?
My biggest success in life is that there are people that know they can trust me, including my wife and children, that I will do right by them, and that my reputation is that I'm a decent human being.
I agree. So tell me, what is your biggest failure in life? What did you learn from it?
My biggest failure in life is I spent far too much time believing I can control the outcome of everything that was going on around me. And took me far too long to realize that everybody's on their own journey. And your job isn't to be the captain of their journey. Your job is to be the support staff in their journey.
Mm. Yeah. That's a hard pill to swallow, man. You know, like, especially when there's people out there who you care about, who, you know, make choices that hurt you.
Yeah.
That is a hard pill to swallow when you realize there's literally nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a fair amount of happiness that comes from accepting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's a hard one for me because, you know, I'm somebody who I feel like I'm a little extreme in accountability. I mean, like, probably people would say I'm too hard on myself, I think, when it comes to things, and that, like, whenever, because I'm of the opinion, like, listen, like, I will absolutely accept all of my successes as mine, right?
Sure. But
that means that all of my failures are mine too, right? And so,
if you don't learn from it, man.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, but I think what I mean is that, like, so when something happens, it's almost, I think there's a religious component too, quite frankly, where it's like one of these things where, okay, so all of your blessings are obedience to the law upon which it's predicated, right? So, sure. So if things are going really well, it must be because I'm doing things right. And if things are going wrong or things went sour, it must be because I did something wrong. And that's not always the case. Sometimes it's just someone else's free agency.
You know, I worked in insurance for about 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. And my wife and I have a consulting business now, and so I'm not in insurance. But, you know, when I talk to people about life insurance, I say, look, you can eat right, you can exercise, you can do all the things that are right. You go to the doctor, make sure you take your vitamins and everything else. But at the end of the day, if somebody else runs a stop sign or a stoplight, that could be the end of your story, and you didn't do anything to cause it to happen. Mm-hmm. You just got to accept the fact that certain things are just outside of your control.
Yeah.
But it is hard. It is hard, especially for people who are high energy, high accountability, you know, goal oriented, to accept the fact that they're not in control. And once I stopped trying to control everyone and everything around me, whew, the burden that just, it was, dropping weights off my shoulders to say, oh, this isn't my fault.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So last question. One day, we hope long, long, long time from now, you're going to pass away. There'll be a funeral and someone will give you a eulogy. What is the one thing you hope somebody says about you in your eulogy?
You know, I think it goes back to my success is that this was a person that loved people and was loved by people, and that tried to do the right thing and tried to lift other people's burden along the way.
Mm. Yeah, man. You know,
this will sound probably terrible and at the same time kind of funny. I tell people all the time, you know, unless you pull a Jesus or a Hitler, people are going to forget you within two generations. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know really anything about my great-grandparents or my great-great-grandparents. And I highly doubt my great-great-great-grandchildren will know much about me. Now, maybe that'll be different because they'll be able to pull up, you know, Facebook posts to say, oh, here is him watching movies, or here is him with his friends, or hey, guess what? He was on the Edlo podcast before it blew up and had 25 million subscribers, right?
Right.
But, you know, like I said, unless we pull a Hitler or a Jesus, like for the most part, most of us just simply fade into the timeline. And so the people that knew me, the people that saw me, I hope they can say this is a guy who was who helped other people along the way.
Yeah. Well, I think you have, man. Like you definitely have been a huge part of my life. We still talk, we still text, we still send each other funny memes, most of them inappropriate, we shouldn't share. But like
you got a court order.
No, but man, you know, that's the thing. There's a few people, like I was telling my son, and there's a few people out there who are ride or die, you know, that'll be there forever. And you may not talk to them every day, but when you do talk to them, it's like no time's passed. And you're one of those guys, you know, it doesn't matter where life has taken us. We always, whenever we get together, it's like just old times, you know? And so, you know, we've been in trouble together. We've laughed together. We've cried together. You know, we've seen each other grow up and have kids and have great times and bad times. And, you know, I'm proud of who you become. You're a good guy, you know,
I'm proud of you, man.
And, you know, for all those suckers who thought we weren't going to amount to much, look at us now. sure we're a mess, but we got money.
Who's not?
I was joking with somebody and I was like, look, money and looks ain't everything, but it's all I got, you know.
I think I might have one of the two. As I tell people, you know, I look like someone left the yogurt out of the fridge at this point.
Oh man, no man, you look great. And like I said, dude, you look like you've lost some weight. You look like you've been putting some work in. So
you know, it's a hell of a thing. I found out that if I just put down the donut, the weight started to come off.
No, it's a crazy thing when you actually pay attention and don't eat everything in sight. Yeah, man.
Right.
Well, listen, for everyone who's listening, thanks for following along with us. This was really more for us than any of you, so I'm surprised if you're still listening. But if you are, subscribe. Brian, where can someone follow you if they want to follow your stand-up, man?
Yeah, Rodda Comedy on Instagram, RODDA Comedy. You know, I'm posting stuff there, and I've got Rodda Comedy on Facebook as well. I try to post some of my clips. If you're offended by it, know that I'm just joking. If you're not offended by it and you like it, drop me a note, drop me a line, drop me a follow.
Right on, man. All right. And so those of you who are listening, don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. And Brian, I'm sure we're going to have to get Chris and we'll just do like a three-way of us just like talking trash and just talking about all the crazy stuff we did. I'm sure Chris will really appreciate us outing him. So
can we talk about the little fine hairs that he always had on the tip of his nose?
Dude. Okay, I gotta say this story though. This is funny. You weren't around when this happened. So, you know, I used to work in a hair salon.
Oh yeah.
And before he moved out to Arizona with you. And so he of course, in typical Chris fashion, would take advantage of my advantages of working at the hair salon. And so he would come in and he would get free haircuts from the manager, right? And you knew Chris, I mean, his eyebrows were notorious. Like, you know what I mean? He had like these big bushy eyebrows, which like,
he had crawling across his face.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, girls dug him. Like, even though, you know, like it was part of his look. Well, she took a stab at cutting those down. And you, dude, I have never seen Chris so scared in his life than when those scissors came towards his eyebrows. Dude, it was like the funniest thing. And then we ought to have him on here so we can tell the cake story. You were around cake, weren't you? The girl he kissed at the tree.
Oh, and we're going to talk about people kissing. Was this the girl that he didn't speak to once, but like slowed down many, many times? And she tried to talk to him, and he just goes,
yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Because we challenge,
he holds the record.
Talking.
Well, To this day, he holds the record for kissing a girl in the least amount of words. Zero.
Zero. Well, hold on. I think we've all pulled that move, but I think that is that he has the most interactions without actually talking to her.
That was the funniest thing, because I remember him coming up to me. I don't know if it was you or someone else, but we were standing there, and he comes up to us, and he's like, yeah, we didn't talk at all. And I go, really? And he goes, I'm going to go dance with her again. And I'm going to try to kiss her without saying a word. And I was like, dude, boss move. You got to do it.
It was epic.
And he did it. Yeah, man. That was.
There are a lot of stories that we didn't even scratch the surface of here.
Yeah, we got to get Chris here so we can just start talking trash about the funny stuff we did. But yeah, man. Well, it was great, man. I love you. You know I do. And we'll talk to everybody later. Bye bye.
Bye now.